What's your favorite carnival game? How many of you like pig races? Raise your hand. Nobody? How many of you like the game where you throw the darts at the balloon? Anybody? Does anybody like carnival games? Does anybody even pay $3 for carnival games? I mean, seriously. I mean, you just pass them by. I feel always so sorry for people at carnival games that are tending them, the, you know, carnival barkers, because they just seem to be sitting there doing nothing. My favorite carnival game is whack-a-mole. I love the game where you stand there in front of the machine and either moles come out or alligators, you know, open their mouths, but moles will come out of these holes and you've got a big bopper, and the goal is you bop the moles as they appear out of the holes. And if you bop a mole, you get some points, and if you get some points, you get some tickets, you get some tickets, you get some stuff from China. It's awesome. I love carnival games. It's fabulous. Today I want you to fix that image of whack-a-mole in your mind. Because today I want to use that image, I want to use that game as kind of the lens through which we see what's happening in Mark chapter 8. Last week we dealt with the temptation of Jesus as he went out into the wilderness for 40 days. That was the internal experience of God's Son. The internal experience of our sinfulness in himself, the tempting, the taunting of the devil. This week, in the second week of Lent, we fix our eyes on the cast of characters that surrounds Jesus. And in this particular text, our eyes are typically drawn to look at who in this text? Peter, of course. Peter, the one who helpfully says, "Hey, Jesus, I will guard and protect you. I will not let any harm befall you." And yet Jesus turns to him and says, "Get behind me, Satan." It is a divine form of whack-a-mole. And Jesus, when he hits Peter with those words, with that stinging rebuke, Peter had to feel as if he just got whacked back down into his disciple hole. And, by the way, it should be noted, it's not just Peter who's getting whacked on top of the head. He was surrounded by the disciples. Peter may be the guy who's talking, but it's the entire band of Jesus' followers who are involved in his utterance, his speech. Not just Peter who is getting rebuked, it's the disciples who, as a group, are setting themselves up against the will of God for his Son, against the plan of Jesus to go to the cross. But we're not just playing whack-a-mole with a single hole in the game console. No, there's more holes in this game. One of the holes is filled in the first paragraph by the elders, the teachers of religious law, and the religious leaders themselves. Whack, whack, whack. As we come into this reading for today, we see that these leaders of the Jewish people, they are the ones that are being struck by God too. And what's interesting about this is if you put them in, if you put yourself in their shoes, if you imagine in Mark chapter 8, not knowing how this whole story is going to end at the cross and empty tomb, if you put yourself in the story, the religious leaders and teachers of the law have to be thinking to themselves, "Now wait a second, I really don't like you, Jesus, but I'm not ready to kill you yet, for goodness sakes. We've got another 7 chapters till we get to that point, frankly," right? And yet Jesus strikes them in their hearts and souls, and says, you too will be part of the way in which God lives out his plans, and you will do that in a way that is exceptionally antagonistic to me. But it's not just the religious leaders or the merry band of disciples. There's one more group. There's one more hole in the game console, and that belongs in the third paragraph of our text, to the crowds. These crowds who have been at varying times an adoring group of fans and groupies, and now they are in a place of trying to figure out how to how to receive the disciples and still be honoring to their religious leaders, these crowds that will ultimately get to the end of Mark and Matthew and Luke as well and say, crucify him, the crowds themselves get whacked on the head. The crowds get told that unless you deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me, you are outside of the will of my Father. You're not worthy, striking words, you are not worthy to be my disciples. This is a text that can simply be summarized with the phrase whack-a-mole. And God's doing the whacking. And here's the key for us in Lent, all of us in this room today in Lent. Nobody escapes God's law. Nobody, because of their own merit, can escape God's judgment. Everybody, in some way over time, each one of you, and myself included, will set ourselves up against the Lord's Christ, against God's Son. In recent weeks and months, I've spent some time thinking about a serious topic, and that is what Christian discipleship is all about, and especially what evangelical Christianity and following Christ is all about in our country. It's a big topic. A lot of books, a lot of journal articles being written right now as everybody considers what is this new age of evangelical Christianity in which we find ourselves. And one of the areas in which I've been doing some significant reading is the power of social location in defining one's evangelical Christianity, in defining the way in which you go about living the course of your life and charting the path that's ahead of you as a follower of Jesus. What I mean is simply to say that if you're an evangelical, Bible-believing, Christ-confessing Christian who lives in suburban St. Louis, you are probably going to look at the world significantly different than someone that lives in a metro or urban area among the impoverished poor. If you are a Christian who believes in Jesus, who promises that you're going to live yourself and your lives in keeping with the moral code of the Ten Commandments, that you believe the Bible, but you live in Wyoming, you're probably going to make different choices and have a different value system than the same person who confesses Jesus, believes the Bible, commits to living a holy life, but lives in the Bay Area of California. Yes? There's a little bit of difference between people who live in Wyoming and people who live in sunny San Francisco. And the conversation right now is around this. How is it possible that people who can check the same boxes in terms of their beliefs, you know, core beliefs like the Apostles' Creed and that kind of thing, how is it that people that can check the same boxes in terms of your beliefs at the same time can live and choose and value such markedly different paths by which to show forth their Christian understanding of who God is and what He's done for us? Pro this, pro that, anti this, anti that. And the conversation right now is around the whole power of social location. I look into Mark chapter 8 and I scratch my head because we see groups of people that will choose markedly different paths, are driven by markedly different systems of value. Religious leaders, chief priests, teachers of the law, they have made one choice. Disciples who grew up in rural Galilee, another set of choices. A crowd that changes over time and gets torn and pushed and swayed this way and that. And asking the question, what is it for these Jewish people who all can check the same boxes and yet they react so markedly different to Jesus? There is no life. There is no social location. There is no human soul that is not up for receiving some whacks from God. And for all of us who live in this context, and for all evangelical Christians who live in deep urban St. Louis context, and for those Christians who believe the same things we do, who check the same boxes, but live out in the Bay Area of California, wherever it is that you live, wherever it is that you've come from, the prayer that we bring before God today is, dear God, when I need to get whacked, when I need your correction, when I need to hear some kind of rebuke, Lord, let nothing that is of my own making or the making of someone else get in the way of that. Help me in every way to deny everything necessary so that, here's the key, so that Jesus can finally take me to the cross. Because what Jesus does in Mark chapter 8 is he says this, chief priests, religious leaders, rural disciples, crowd from all over the place, we're all going to the same place. We're all going to go to the cross. And if you don't want to go to the cross, and if you don't want to take up the implication of the cross, then you're not worthy to be my disciple. And that's huge. That's huge. It's huge as we debate all kinds of cultural and political pressures in this world, this American world we live in. It's huge as we try to figure out how to raise our kids in this school system and that school system and whatnot. It's huge as we try to figure out all the complexity of life. And Jesus says to us, let's just relocate to the cross. Let's get down to ground zero. Let's go to the place where I get whacked, I get struck, so that you can find out what it means to come out on the other side of that and be welcomed, to be restored, to be healed, to be recalibrated, to be refocused, so that you can be my disciples, having taken up your cross, which is really, in essence, my cross. Over these past few weeks here at Concordia, we've been learning a new rhythm, and that by creating a 7-word sentence to understand and appreciate the gospel of Jesus. The gospel in 7 words is what we're calling it. And inside your worship folder there, actually on the screens at some point in time during the service today, maybe it was before or after the service, you saw these 7 words being put up, creations of congregation members. I just ask you today, what would your 7 words be? What would your 7-word sentence be that would summarize the welcome, the gospel, the love that Jesus Christ shows to his disciples, the crowds, the religious leaders, ultimately through his cross? And the 7 words I came up with for at least something to hang your hat on go like this. In Jesus, God's whack becomes God's welcome. In Jesus, God's whack becomes God's welcome. Regardless of our social location, in spite of our sin, God's desire is for us to know the gospel, to know the way through which all manner of locations and circumstances, he brings us through the cross, and he says, I'm coming to bring you home. So as we come and put toes to the tile, as you relocate from wherever you're sitting in the sanctuary today to this location, as you receive the bread and wine, the body and blood of Christ for the forgiveness of your sins this morning once again, that you would come and lay on this altar everything that you hold on to and cling to and cherish as your security in this world, and you say, dear God, for the sake of your Son Jesus, I'll give it all away so that you can be preeminent. So that you can be my all in all. So that your kingdom may come fully to me and my kingdom may be laid as a sacrifice to you.